Looks like everyone's ready to go. I'll ask our marshal to call the court to order.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Riley, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
At this time, I want to remind the attorneys that the rules that apply in appellate court are the same, even though we are doing this by video. Each of you will have 15 minutes to relate your case in chief. 5 minutes will be reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Please mute your mic when you're not speaking. With that said, I'll call the next case, A20-0382, in re Stephen A. Lawrence et al. Petitioners. And we realize that this did start with a writ, and that's where we're at this time. So go ahead when you're ready to make your comments.
Good morning. Rich Ostlund here, representing the petitioners. Petitioners all with me here today, Your Honors, in a large conference room, socially distanced, of course. I point that out because, well, you can't tell this from the caption of the case, certainly from the full record. It's very significant what we're talking about here today, certainly in terms of the attorney-client privilege, a privilege that existed between our clients, these 12 individuals and their associated companies, and the Kaplan Strange and Kaplan firm, Ralph Strandis, for over 35 years. With the exception of two twins that are Eric and his sister, who are Steve's children, who are in their 50s, the range of ages, the average age is 75, the range of ages is 68 to 83, and Ralph Strandis was over 81 when he did this transaction, one of the deans of the commercial bar, certainly in this state. The reason I point that out is because what I want to do with my time today is to make two or three essential points. Each of the judges on this panel are highly respected, always prepared. We understand and we appreciate that. But here, fundamentally, as I'll touch on, and without an effort to go through all the briefing and say things again that we've said before, but really focus on the unique attributes of this attorney-client relationship between these 12 individuals and their lawyer of 30-some years, having done business together all in and around Red Wing, Minnesota, outstate Minnesota, there to Rochester and a variety of places. And it's very important because when we look at the issues of privilege that stand at the core of this issue before you today, the law has been very clear in Minnesota and consistently around the country that a privilege exists both directly and in dual or multiple fashions. So you can have, as we had here, the Lawrence group of companies represented by Ralph Strandis, who sadly passed away just as this case was beginning, but for virtually Steve's entire career. And he brought his family members and friends along, and this transaction, they were investors and with him, and this was basically the ending of a life's work for him and investments involving his family and friends, all people and business people from in and around Red Wing and that portion of outstate Minnesota. And when we look at the issues—
Mr. Ostlund, this is Judge Riley, and I'm gonna have this question for both you and Mr. Cheetah. I think we all agree that there's very little case law in this area. And so if we were to publish, I would like both of you to answer what the syllabus point or points would be.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Right when you said what the blank points would be, and I want to make sure I heard you because my hearing isn't what it used to be.
What the syllabus point would be, or points. So the principle of law. And then the second question I have, as I understand your argument, you are saying, and I'll just call them Kaplan for the law firm and Ralph Strandis, but that firm represented the sellers of the business. And so that would be both the corporate sellers and the individual shareholders. Is that that's what you're arguing, right?
Correct.
And so the individual shareholders or sellers included not only the people who are presumably sitting in the room, the Lawrence family, but it also was Mr. Krell and Mr. Schultz. Were they also, I think you said Mr. Krell had like 0.1% of the company.
Mr. Krell and Mr. Schultz were also selling shareholders. And they were also represented by Kaplan Strandis in connection with that matter.
Okay, thank you.
So that's a perfect, thank you for the question.
I have a question now, Mr. Oslin, and this is such an elementary question, but I keep going back to what the relief was that you're seeking. You're seeking a writ. It's an extraordinary remedy. I mean, you accept and acknowledge that you have the burden here, right?
Certainly.
Okay, when you certainly say, well, this is what bothers me then. As far as the burden is concerned, have you necessarily ferreted out what may, and do you get what I mean? There's so many volumes of documents, so many reams of paper that are either attorney-client privilege or not. I mean, have you went to the steps to say, well, this was clearly before the sale of the stock, so therefore that shouldn't even be under the microscope versus other forms of information? Or isn't that even a problem? Maybe it's not even a problem and I'm making it into one.
Well, first of all, we have, Your Honor, I mean, we have prepared, as part of the record, a very lengthy, detailed privilege log of all the documents that are in issue here. We did not learn that they had been inadvertently included in a server transfer approximately 18 months. We learned about approximately 18 months after the transaction when the lawsuit was going on.
Well, and they were transferred. I understand that, Mr. Oslin, I understand that the log, I do. I know all the trouble that you went to put that information into the log, but is it, for us, as far as a reviewing court, should we just then accept that those are the documents that are in dispute and not worry about whether some of them may have predated anything that had to do with the sale of the stock?
For purposes of this hearing, yes. I really want to answer your questions in a concise way. Let's see if I can answer all the questions in my next minute or so of a presentation. Because what's fundamental here is, even though it comes up on a discovery motion, embedded inside that discovery motion is a question on the law of attorney-client privilege in the state of Minnesota. And Minnesota is consistent with the second restatement, or the third restatement rather, of the law of attorneys, and we provided that in the briefing, and it's very clear that in that instance, really two things. One, if there is a joint representation, multiple parties represented by the same lawyer, the same firm, that can be waived only by the express and clear waiver or consent by action or by words, by each of those separate parties. That's the law. And what we have here is a situation that is fundamentally important. And this is the reason, not just to give you interesting background about where these companies were, where these individuals were, but what they did was to practice, or I'm sorry, to do business in the way that we've described with their personal lawyer for 35 years. And these were all rolled up in a single company, and they spun out one of those to sell. Everything about the way they've done business for those three plus decades, everything about their experience, their trust in Ralph, he was their lawyer for personal and business purposes. And as you go into this and you look at this transaction and you ask yourself, okay, what's at stake on this motion? Okay, is there in any way seriously an argument that the respondents, the buyers, are being deprived of something that they expected to receive as a part of the negotiations here? Absolutely not. On the other hand, is it absolutely clear from the way that these sellers and their lawyer spoke, acted, conducted? This is a test that's not presented in a vacuum, but with respect, we would say you have to look at the way in which these particular lawyers and these particular clients acted and over what period of time. And there is no doubt that they looked to and considered Ralph as their lawyer, both as sellers, and sellers is a defined term in that contract multiple places. It's identified them as individuals and LTX, the company. And so there is, if my comments can be of assistance to you in trying to weigh and balance the things at issue here, there is a very strong presumption in the law favoring the attorney-client privilege in Minnesota and everywhere for good reason. So here you look at the expectations of these individuals and the way they acted. There is every reason to honor that here. And then when you take a look and take it a step further, and there's two fundamental things that the trial judge did here that were mistaken. Number one, what he did was to conclude that LTX controlled the privilege when the facts show just the opposite. Well, and the law behind
Let me just ask for clarification. I understood in your stipulated facts, you stipulated that none of the individual sellers, the Lawrence parties themselves, or the KSK attorneys were involved in the data migration, because that's what the judge said is the conduct on the corporation conduct as far as data migration was the waiver. Was that a part of your stipulation?
That's true. And that's a very important point, but I'm not talking about that right now. I'm talking about the predicate issue. We don't even reach the waiver question if the law is accurately applied here to say that each of these individuals held the privilege and no one of them could waive it by action or word without the express consent of everybody else. That never happened here.
So, Mr. Oslin, it's Judge Riley. My question is that in Judge Wall's order, he did not really discuss the difference, or he didn't discuss co-joint clients or co-clients. He just said that the corporation held the privilege. How much was that argued to him? And then secondly, with regard to, for instance, Eric, who helped with the migration, you would agree that under the restatement and case law, that if there were communications that impacted only him, under Judge Wall's waiver analysis, he may have waived as to his individual privileged communications, for instance.
Well, you know, I understand what you're saying. And if the facts were that, then the answer would be yes, he may have. But the point is, what was Eric doing? What's the record show? This is an area where Judge Walls, there was presentation to him in part, but this is where he went off on a tangent and started assuming facts that were not accurate. And in the letter for reconsideration, it was pointed out to him that while he concluded that Eric wasn't a senior manager or officer of LTX, he wasn't. He was acting on behalf of Lawrence Transportation, a company he had purchased. And so nobody, and you're right, Judge Werke, I think it was your question, nobody from the rest of the sellers or from the lawyers knew anything about what was in these servers. This was being done at the IT level. And this is one of those things that when you, in the second point then, is Eric, to the extent he was involved, because nobody intended to waive an attorney-client privilege. To respond to your answer, Judge Riley, he didn't know it was in there. And what we then have here, however, is that the judge takes a look at this, and then he goes down a road of analyzing, well, what server was this on? What email address was this on? I mean, we're all experiencing I'm 64 years old now, and just, you know, learning to do a lot of these sort of things, finally. But the reality is we have digital natives and digital immigrants. And this group, this 81-year-old lawyer, this group of clients in their 70s who lived a lifetime trusting and being able to rely on the communications with their lawyer, the idea that it would register to them just because this was being sent on maybe a company email or it might end up on a server, how would they possibly know where this stuff ends up? This cannot be the fair standard for determining whether or not we have a waiver and attorney-client privilege. And if you look at the facts with which the judge declined to do, This is a major area where he missed facts in the first go round, and he declined to get involved and consider the facts on the second go round. And you look at in context this particular group of clients, and it's unquestionable that they didn't know, perceive, intend to waive that attorney-client privilege by conduct or by action. And so, Judge Werke, to your point,
you have under a minute left, and you haven't answered my first question, which is, what would the syllabus point be?
The syllabus point would be, and I think there are really two, Your Honor. The syllabus point would be, number one, that attorney-client privilege cannot be waived in the state of Minnesota unless there is consent by each of the holders of that privilege, and the writ of probation being granted because the trial judge abused his discretion. And frankly, on this issue, even though these motions come up on an abuse of discretion, he simply applied the law incorrectly. The second thing is that on the question of waiver, and for him to determine that under these facts, there are facts that weren't before him. He guessed on those facts. He failed to consider them. He wouldn't consider them. And I want to close with offering three very quick comments, because those are words that are wiser than any I could think of. The first is from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who said many things in her life, but she said, one, I'm a very strong believer in listening and learning from others. Secondly, John Kenneth Galbraith, perhaps one of the most influential economists of this century, stated, faced with the choice between changing one's mind and proving that there is no reason to do so, almost everybody gets busy on the proof. And finally, Don Maynard Keynes, who I picked only because I know that he was someone that Galbraith leaned heavily on, a very famous British economist, said, when the facts change, I change my mind. So here,
okay, I do need to point out, Mr. Oslin, your time has expired. I let you name drop because you started with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but you do need to wrap up.
I will, and I'll say one thing, and I'll take this out of my rebuttal time. At the end of the day, the fact of the matter is this was decided on incorrect law, mistaken facts, and when those facts were all before the judge, he declined to do so. And I'll remain patient and waiting to answer the rest of the questions that I didn't get to and my other comments on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Oslin. We'll turn now to you, Mr. Cheeto.
Morning, Your Honors. Counsel, Ryan Cheeto for the respondents. May it please the court. This is an important issue for my clients. The petitioners see it in their briefing that the emails that we're talking about could have a dispositive impact in this litigation. And I believe these emails will ultimately prove that my client was defrauded. So this isn't some sort of sideshow or gotcha motion or academic exercise. This is the heartbeat of the case, Your Honors. Judge Riley, I'd like to start by answering your question on the syllabus. The syllabus should say that a writ of prohibition is an extraordinary remedy, and it can only be granted if there is no support in the record for what the judge ruled. The second point should be that the district court has wide latitude in ruling on discovery issues. And the
I can't hear you, Mr. Cheetah. Mr. Cheetah, somehow you got muted. Mr. Cheetah, can you hit your mute
button? Your Honor. How much did you miss?
Well, we got the first suggestion on the syllabus point, but why don't you restate that? Because that is a concern of ours if these matters are of first impression.
I understand, Your Honors. Thank you. I'll restart with the syllabus. So point one in the syllabus would be that a writ of prohibition is an extraordinary remedy. And the trial court's order can only be reversed if the information at issue is clearly not discoverable. That's the standard. The second point in the syllabus should be that the district court has wide latitude in issuing discovery orders. And the third point in the syllabus should be that the district court did not abuse its discretion in finding a waiver under the unique facts of this case. So
Mr. Cheeto, One of the things that we do when we're looking at writs, which is typically what we're not looking at, it is an extraordinary remedy. In the unpublished case of Truscott, which came out recently, the judge reversed the district court, or our panel reversed the district court, because the district court didn't adequately look at a remedy at law. So in essence, once the horse is out of the barn, it's hard to get it back in. How would you respond to that in this situation?
Your Honor, I'd respond to that by saying Judge Wall did not resolve the underlying motion by reference to as an issue of law or an issue of first impression. He applied black letter Minnesota law, starting with the Kobluk case, the foundational case. He resolved this as a matter of fact, and I think that's a different standard even on a writ of prohibition when the district court judge has weighed the facts and the evidence. I think you are in an abuse of discretion standard of review at that point, which I think the petitioners have also conceded. So I do think that's an important distinction in this case, was how Judge Wall resolved this issue. And the purported facts that he is said not to have considered, those were all brought up in a motion for reconsideration in an effort to supplement the record after appeal. Judge Wall afforded the parties here extraordinary opportunities to put in whatever evidence they wanted to put in prior to issuing the ruling. The petitioners had months to prepare the privilege log and submit whatever evidence they wanted. The judge let us go take another deposition of Kristen Winter and submit arguments that we wanted. So to say that after the judge has issued his order, I'm going to try to add new facts, reported facts, and make new arguments that I didn't make before, that's completely improper under the Spotwell standard. So that's my answer to your question, Your Honor. I hope that's responsive. Kristen Leonard really had it right. I think her testimony is really important in this case. The case really boils down to common sense, company property, and communications with the company lawyers, and the application of black letter Minnesota law. So we go back to Kobluk, where Judge Wall started. This is not new law. Privilege is important, yes. There are important policies for protecting privilege, but the privilege is not without limits. And that's because it acts as a barrier to testimonial disclosure and tends to suppress relevant facts. And therefore, we narrowly construe it. Kobluk also teaches that the party resisting disclosure bears the burden of proof, which Judge Wall cited, which I think is another important feature in this case. Who bore the burden of proof? It was the petitioners. And Mr. Oslin this morning has talked about emails that may have been from the individual sellers. You won't find them on this privilege log. This privilege log includes only emails identified as being sent through the company's email domain and computer system. That's it. It doesn't reflect emails that were not sent through the company's system because of the way these emails were migrated to Ream. And so if there were such evidence, it was incumbent upon the petitioners to bring that to Judge Wall's attention. They didn't. And I do believe, by the way, that Judge Wall did leave room open for a different result for communications other than the set that's at issue here. He did have a footnote that he's prepared to appoint retired Judge Vandenort to resolve any other issues, but he's resolving issues relating to this set of communications sent over the company email system. The third important point from Kobluk, that case instructs that the veil of confidentiality is lifted if the client and lawyer fail to take all steps reasonably necessary to prevent disclosure. So the district court's analysis here really turned on a fact question, and Judge Wall analyzed several factors based on the facts in the record to find that the privilege for this set of communications vested with the company. It was the environment in which the emails were sent through the company email system and the company servers. And it was the context in which they were sent with company counsel regarding corporate transactions in connection with which the company was billed for the legal services, the company was identified as who the legal services were provided for, and the company paid the bills. There was also a lack of any clear delineation by the petitioners in the work that they say that Kaplan Strangis was performing for the corporation versus the individuals. Remember, there were two separate transactions here. There's the corporate restructuring transaction. That's when the corporations were restructured. That was all at the corporate level. And that's the invoice that says for services provided to LTX Inc. and its affiliates. And then there's the stock purchase, which occurs many months later. And the trial court said, you didn't distinguish, you know, which was which, if there were communications with individuals you wanted me to look at versus the corporation. Again, citing the burden of proof. The inclusion of Ms. Linner, a corporate employee, on the email communications. And ultimately, the failure of the petitioners who had the burden to establish the privilege to delineate in their privilege log communications specific to the corporation versus communications specific to the individual sellers or otherwise provide information to establish privilege of the sellers as to the transferred communications. So let's take a big step back. There was reference to the stipulated facts. The parties agreed that there were a set of stipulated facts and 22 exhibits that could be put before the district court that included information germane to its resolution of the issues here.
Do you think that we should look at the restatement of the law governing lawyers, section 75, and the other sections referenced in that to help inform our analysis?
The Minnesota Supreme Court has never adopted that section, Your Honor, at least as far as I've been able to tell. But if you do choose to look at that section, we would still prevail for several reasons. First, the sellers here consented to a stock sale. And in a stock sale, that's going to include all of the assets, all of the liabilities of the company, which would naturally include all of its documents, all of its emails, and all of its other property. The sellers could have taken steps to prevent those assets from being transferred.
But Judge Wall's order, he found that the privileged documents remained with the selling company and weren't transferred. And you didn't appeal to that finding.
That is correct, Your Honor. He didn't resolve it as a matter of joint privilege, nor did he need to because of the environment in which these emails were sent. In the face of a clear company policy saying, if you're sending emails over the company email system, those are company property and you have no right of expectation of privacy. To that point, the notion that none of the sellers knew what was on these servers or in these emails, Your Honor, is under section 10.13 of the stock purchase agreement. Mr. Lawrence was appointed as the seller's representative, as the seller's attorney. In fact, he was given complete and unfettered authority to act on their behalf. And Mr. Lawrence appears on the vast majority of these emails on the privilege log and knew full well what he was sending and where he was sending and how he was sending it. Moreover, Kristen Leonard had a mirror image of his inbox, which Mr. Lawrence knew. In fact, Ms. Leonard testified everybody knew it, including the lawyers at Kaplan Strangis. So stepping back, Your Honor, I do want to be responsive to your question on the restatement. No, I don't think you need to get there to affirm Judge Wall. But if the court were inclined to look at that section, I think we do have consent here because we have sellers consenting to a stock sale where all of the assets are going to a new buyer. On these facts, I think there is consent. And secondly, I think that the rule being advocated here is probably a field too far. I get it in the context of a spousal privilege, for example, if I wanted to testify against my wife, my spouse could say, you can't testify and prevent me from doing that. And I think that's what the restatement provision is really driving at, is you have joint criminal defendants and one is going to testify against the other about a privileged conversation. I can prevent you from doing that. But let's change the hypothetical here to, we have two parties who consult a lawyer and they have privileged documents. One of them decides to take those documents and throw them in the garbage. And they end up at the garbage dump. And a third party discovers those communications and then publishes them in a private way. Would we say that there's not been a waiver because there were two parties to that communication, I think we would say that you failed to take reasonable steps to protect the confidentiality of your information. Take that a step further, that the co-defendants could have contracted amongst themselves to say, you, co-defendant, will not disclose any of this information. You will take steps to keep it confidential. Or yet a step further, we're not throwing in the trash, we're handing the documents over to a document shredding company, saying, these are confidential, these are highly confidential privileged documents. You, document shredding company, have to treat these as confidential and make sure that they don't see the light of day, and we have a contractual agreement. And that's really what could have occurred here. There are all kinds of practical steps. I hear the argument that, well, this just isn't fair. It is fair, because these are sophisticated business people. Mr. Lawrence himself is an attorney. He's the seller's representative. The sellers could have instructed him to take steps to keep this information confidential. And certainly Mr. Lawrence and the deal lawyers could have taken steps. And these aren't hard steps to take. The very first is drafting a contractual provision. Your Honors, there's the Great Hill Equity case that talked about, well, if there's some notion of unfairness here, parties can always invoke their right to contractual freedom, to draft provisions. And there are countless examples about how to achieve that. I do want to highlight one case on that point. It's Shareholder Representative Services versus RSI Holdco LLC. That's cited in our brief. That's a follow-on case from Great Hill Equity, where there was a contractual provision saying, you buyer have to keep these confidential. These are our privileged communications. You can't disclose that privileged information. Well, guess what? There was an email transfer, not unlike the one here, where all of the emails with deal counsel get in the hands of the buyer. And the court and the buyer said, well, that's a waiver, because notwithstanding the contractual provision, we still receive the emails, and that's a waiver. And the court said, not in the context of a contractual right. The parties exercised their contractual freedom. You drafted specific provisions about who was going to own this part of the assets being purchased and the privilege, and you agreed to it. We're going to enforce that right, notwithstanding where the emails ultimately ended up. So that's ultimately the answer, Your Honors, here, is there should have been a contractual provision and there should have been a carve-out. And I will say that the parties here knew how to exclude assets from this stock purchase if they wanted to. The stock purchase agreement is Exhibit 6 to the stock purchase agreement, and it includes Exhibit E, which is excluded assets. Those assets specifically not included with what the buyer was getting. They knew how to do it. And I do see I'm out of time, Your Honors. Unless any of you have questions, I'm happy to answer them.
There's no questions, Mr. Cheetah. Thank you very much. We'll turn it back to you, Mr. Goslin. A reminder, Mr. Goslin, you are muted. There you go.
Hear me okay? Can you hear me now?
We can.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to make four very brief points. And I think they're really fundamental to crystallizing what you've heard today. I was surprised to hear it, but relieved in some fashions when, in terms of counsel, the very first comment he made to you, which is that these are really important documents to us. We think we can use them to win a lawsuit. Well, that's not the standard. And it highlights what's really going on here. Is this something that came up in the ordinary course of business right after the sale because these were documents that the buyers needed in the ordinary course? That would be things, by the way, even if the respondents had appealed the decision of judge concluding that this stuff remained privileged, which they didn't, of course, as you noted, Judge Riley, most of the last 5 minutes of their argument talked about, well, he should have ruled differently on that, but he didn't. He consistently ruled with Minnesota law and thoughtful on other jurisdictions, concluding that, no, it was intended to be privileged. And the facts are very consistent with that. When did they come to us and tell us they discovered they had them? 18 months later when they're getting into a lawsuit. The standard here cannot be, you need to give them to us so we can win in a lawsuit, okay? It's even more critical to look then in this situation when indeed the lawyer can't even testify to explain what the comments and so forth were because he's deceased. So here we have a situation where, for all these reasons, you, with respect, we say you need to really carefully consider the purpose of what discovery would be here. Are they really being deprived of something that they would otherwise have a right to see or should have counted on seeing? And the answer is clearly no. And then we look at what Judge Wall did. And you know, he's a brilliant man. He's very experienced there, but his life, of course, was in a giant law firm, dealing with large transactions, complex disputes, and so forth. And we all have flat spots. We all resist changing our minds. And fundamentally, what happened here? Even though counsel kind of obscures things or tries to by saying, well, they had months and documents and so forth, the fundamental fact here is that the judge made decisions on facts he assumed to exist that didn't and were wrong. They were wrong in terms of things that were put in front of him, like his belief that Eric somehow was a senior managing person that could be attributed to a waiver. And they were wrong because he made entirely different factual incorrect assumptions about Mr. Krell and him not being adverse. And when that was all presented to him, and we went back, we did what the rules require in 115, he wouldn't even listen. Counsel suggests that somehow he considered everything because we had the right to send a letter. Well, he sent us one back that says, I'm not considering it. So all of the things here that would go into the hopper for trying to come up with a just and sensible resolution to preserve the privilege from inadvertently becoming a weapon in the hands of
Mr.
people
Aslan,
that didn't
Mr. Aslan, I'd like you to, you are bringing up the documents that were submitted on reconsideration, right? You'd like this court to look at them. So would you explain in response to the respondent's arguments why those documents were not submitted with the initial briefing? Thank you.
Correct. Thank you for the question. It's because no one argued, the petition, the respondents never argued that there was a waiver here because Krell and Eric had the authority to do that. There were no facts there to that dealt with the question at all about Krell being adverse. The entire basis upon which the judge went through this gymnastics that included reference to what email server and so forth, which by the way is still irrelevant to a 70-year-old. You push a button, it goes, you know, you get the message. This, but the point you raise is fundamental to this. He just assumed too much and then he wouldn't change his mind. And you know, I don't care how experienced we are, how smart we are, we all have flat spots. And that's one of the things that I would go back to Judge Ginsburg, say, when I listen, I tend to learn things. And that's where the abuse of discretion is most clear, especially on what counsel admits is what they want to be a case dispositive as you're trying to prove fraud here. And Judge Bratvold, I read a decision issued by your, I don't have the name right in front of me because I left it at my chair, but it talks about, you know, privilege is supposed to be the last thing that you're allowed to get into and trying to prove up a case. And here they talk about throwing things in the garbage and so forth. That isn't our facts. It's just obscure. At the end of the day, if this were allowed to stand, it does change Minnesota law. You know, whether the Supreme Court has specifically referred to the restatement or not, the reality is we have clear Minnesota law that says you have to have a knowing, intentional waiver by action or deed of a privilege. It also says if there's a joint privilege, one party can't waive it for the other. And when you look at this,
Mr. Aslan,
none of the things that counsel mentioned.
Mr. Aslan, your time has run up. If you'll run out, if you'll sum up your point.
Thank you. None of what we have here amounts to an issue or a reasonable question, reasonable conclusion that there was a knowing and intentional waiver. And so we request with respect that you grant the writ of prohibition and you put this case back on track to a trial on the merits without invasion of attorney-client privileges on either side. Thank you very much.
Thank you. On behalf of the panel, I'd like to thank both attorneys for arguing today. The arguments were excellent and they will aid us in making our determination on this case. The matters are deemed submitted.